discretion to take you away, and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you.
كل صبح وكل شراب ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Do you want to be healthy and feel good? Perhaps you won't find anyone not sharing this goal. Whilst there's a plethora of advice online and by experts, we have wonderful recommendations in Islamic teachings, including the sayings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. They all lived a healthy life and would love their followers to be healthy too. For instance, I have personally found hundreds of narrations on healthy lifestyle from the Commander of the Faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi as-salam. Here are tips in this regard. The art of eating. In advice to his son Imam al-Hasan alayhi as-salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, peace be upon him, states, "Do not eat unless you're hungry. Leave eating whilst you're still hungry and chew the food very well." Number 5, do not overeat. Overeating causes illness. Excessive eating corrupts the soul. Be wary of eating too much, for it darkens the heart. These are some of the narrations from Imam Ali Salam highlighting the dangers of excessive consumption of food. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we lose self-control or feel pressure to eat. Even those may be situations where we may not be hungry. For example, we find ourselves when we have to eat from buffets or when we go from one invitation to another. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali Salam once again links food consumption to the health of one's soul, the nafs, and highlights how the path of spirituality is illuminated with moderation and avoidance of excessiveness. In the book Ghurar al-Hikam, Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, "If you reduce how much you eat, your intellectual ability will enhance." Number 6, the night worship. At first glance, you might be thinking, how is this linked to a healthy lifestyle? Well, in a number of traditions, it is reported that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, to stay up at night worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings about health for the body, pleasure of the Lord, adherence to the ways of the prophets, and pouring of God's mercy. This is probably mainly linked to praying the night prayer, Salatul Layl, which can be prayed any time at night, but preferably after midnight.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شهان بات، Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their park 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So, in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution, or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen. How people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Jenny Miller, Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy. Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area. Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste, near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but eight Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There's a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone, has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, the Sunday Times rich list. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than double or triple their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out suddenly. Out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia, and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his 5-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Al
outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime military has intensified its attacks in Jenin in recent weeks. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Jenin Fiercely Resists Zionist Regime's Constant Attacks. Here's the story. Palestinian teenager was killed by the Zionist regime troops in Jenin recently. Palestinian health authorities identified him as Amjad Walid al-Fayed, 17 years old. The Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad said their member was killed in an exchange of fire between Palestinian resistance fighters and the Zionist regime occupation forces during an Israeli invasion of the northern West Bank city. Hundreds of people turned out for al-Fayed's funeral. The Zionist regime occupation forces killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy during a military raid into the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. A second teen was seriously injured when the Zionist regime forces shot him in the stomach. Islamic Jihad said al-Fayed was related to two Palestinian resistance fighters who fought against the Zionist regime troops during their invasion of Jenin in April 2002. In April 2002, the Zionist regime's military massacred at least 52 Palestinians and injured scores of others in Jenin refugee camp, according to a report by the United Nations Secretary General at the time. The Zionist regime forces also shelled 150 buildings, leaving 450 families homeless. According to the report, 23 Zionist regime troops were dead by the end of the operation. Last week, the Zionist regime forces used a Palestinian teenage girl as a human shield during a firefight with Palestinian resistance fighters in Jenin. The Zionist regime's military besieged the house of Ahad Mohammad Reza Mereb in Jenin's Al-Hadaf neighborhood at 6 a.m. on May 13th in order to arrest her 20-year-old brother. After ordering Ahad's parents and younger brothers out of the house, the Zionist regime's army opened fire at the house where her brother remained. Her brother retaliated by shooting at Israeli regime troops, according to a field investigation by Defense for Children International Palestine. 2 hours later, Palestinian resistance troops began firing heavily at an Israeli regime military vehicle. The troops forced Ahed to stand outside the military vehicle for 2 hours while they sat inside exchanging fire with Palestinian resistance troops. Bullets were being fired at the military vehicle from all directions, Ahed told DCIP. I was trembling and crying and shouting to the troops to remove me because the bullets were passing over my head, Ahed added. But one of them ordered me in Arabic through a small window in the military vehicle, stay where you are and don't move. You are a terrorist. Stand in your place until you say goodbye to your brother. Ahad tried to tilt her head to the side to dodge the bullets, but one of the Israeli troops ordered her to stand up straight, DCIP stated. She was forced to remain there for 2 hours before running near a tree and collapsing. She was treated at the hospital for severe mental distress and low oxygen levels. After evacuating Ahad's house, where she lived with her extended family, including 8 children, the Zionist regime troops bombed the house with rocket-propelled grenades, causing it to catch fire, and then attacked it with live ammunition. In recent weeks, the Zionist regime military has intensified its attacks in Jenin as resistance in its refugee camp has grown more defiant. The Zionist regime forces invaded Jenin refugee camp and the nearby town of Berkin on May 13th, as it has been doing on a nearly daily basis, wounding more than a dozen Palestinians and making arrests. One Israeli regime officer was killed in Berkin that day. The Zionist regime forces sought to arrest Palestinian Mahmoud al-Dubai. The Zionist regime troops surrounded his home and ordered him to surrender himself. following an hours-long exchange of fire between al-Dubai and the Zionist regime occupation forces, which reportedly included Israeli forces firing Energa anti-tank rifle grenades at his house, al-Dubai was arrested. The amount of gunfire aimed at us was indescribable, thousands of bullets. An unnamed senior officer was quoted as saying by Arutz Sheva, a publication supporting Israeli regime settlement activities in the West Bank, adding, "I have been in the army for more than 20 years and I have never seen anything like that." In an effort to find new ways to thwart resistance, the fabricated regime of Israel is considering a return to the use of air raids against the camp, a method of repression the West Bank has not seen since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago. Helicopters and drones may be used to secure ground troops through the use of deterrent fire and possibly shoot at armed combatants, the Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz reported. While the brother of one of six Palestinians who last September escaped from one of the Zionist regime's most fortified prisons has died after being shot by the Zionist regime occupation forces in Jenin. During the fighting in Jenin on May 13th, the Zionist regime troops shot Daoud Zobeidi. He was a brother of Zakaria Zobeidi, the most well-known prisoner who escaped in September. Zakaria Zobeidi is a former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a Fatah-affiliated group. The wound was transferred to the Rambam Hospital in Haifa, where he died on May 15th. The far-right Israeli regime politician Itamar Ben-Gvir visited that hospital shortly before Dawood Zobeidi's death was announced. Ben-Gvir called for Dawood Zobeidi to be executed. The killing of Dawood Zobeidi brings to 228 the number of Palestinians who have died while in the Zionist regime detention. The fabricated regime of Israel is still withholding his body and refusing to hand it over to his family. The Palestinian Prisoners Club said the Zionist regime forces fired at him with the aim of liquidating him. The brother of another escaped prisoner died in fighting with the Zionist regime forces last month. Shams Kamamij, 29, was killed in Kafrdan village on April 14th when the Zionist regime forces opened fire at a crowd of people throwing stones at military vehicles. He was the brother of Ayham, another one of the escapees from Gilboa prison. The escape was viewed as a devastating blow to the reputation of the fabricated regime of Israel and its so-called security apparatus. The prisoners remained at large for days and in some cases weeks before being rearrested.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Kamerayi that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in
the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you both.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding scholars and ulama of the 13th century Hijra, originally from India. He is Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, but mainly known as Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, the author of the magnum opus Abaghatul Anwar. We tried to first take a look at his early life and then at his most outstanding book, that is Abaghatul Anwar. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you. Give us some information about the early life of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Allama Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, or Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, was born in 1246 according to lunar calendar in a village close to the Delhi, capital city of India. And as his name is showing, he was from Sadat. He was from the offspring of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he is named as his grandfather Hamed Hussein. And when we want to trace back his lineage, he goes back to the children of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salatu wasalam, mm-hmm. the seventh Imam of Shia, with 27 means and I mean generations.
Generations, okay.
Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi started his Islamic teachings and Islamic studies when he was 6 years old. And he studied with different teachers, but mainly at the beginning of his studying, his father was the teacher that brought him up according to Islamic school of thought. And when he was 14, he came to study theology and some way finishing fiqh. He studied Islamic jurisprudence with the Sultan ul-Ulama, Sayyid Muhammad bin Dildar Ali, mm-hmm. and also with the brother of his teacher, Sayyid ul-Ulama, Sayyid Hussein bin Dildar Ali. Both of them were the scholars in India. And you know, some of maybe these scholars are not well known to mm-hmm. the rest of Islamic world,
yes.
but they were well known at that time in India.
That's right.
And also, he wrote a book, we should say a commentary, yes. on the book of Manahij al-Tadqiq that was written by his teacher,
right.
Sayyidul Ulama. Okay. And also, he corrected and also tried to publish some of the works of his father,
that's right.
like Futuhat Haydariya, Risale Taqiyya, Tashid al-Mata'in.
Mm-hmm.
And when he moved to Hajj, mm-hmm. he traveled to perform the pilgrimage of Hajj and also went to Atawat Aliyat, to Karbala, Najaf, and yes. Samarra, and Kadhimain.
Yes.
And then he came back to India, and from that moment on, yes. his life is, you know,
right.
more brilliant for
yes,
us, of
right.
course.
Okay.
And we have more information regarding this period of his life.
When we studied the life account of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi and compare it with the other scholars of the Shia studies, we find him from India, something which is very much rare because most of the scholars were either from Iran, Persia, or Iraq, Lebanon, you know. This man is from India. My point is this. He writes a book which becomes one of the most outstanding, you know, books in defense of the Shiism and the Shia beliefs, that is Abaghatul Anwar. First of all, let's talk about the main intention of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi to compile such a book. What was the main goal, Sheikh Mahtavi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That is a good point. I may respond this way, that his main intention is loyalty to the actually a school of thought of Ahlul Bayt and to defend from the truth. Because in his area, I mean, since he's originally from India, mm-hmm. we know that the actually population of Muslim there, I mean, Sunni brothers outnumbered Shia over
yes.
there. So definitely they are going to have more scholars because of the facilities that they have there. But we see over there one book is being published entitled Tuhfatu Ithna Ashariya. When we look at the title of this book, we see it has been actually written in a kind of downgrading Shia sect. That is not the approach of all Sunnis. They do not treat Shias like this. I mean, to entitle your book in a way that it is kind of mockery or making fun of the thing. Mm-hmm. So Tuhfat Ithna Asharia means the present or the gift of Ithna Asharia. So 12 verse. So let's look at this gift. And then he, in his book, he's mm-hmm. trying to reject
Abdul, a person by the name of Abdul Aziz al-Dihlawi.
Yes, this book
has authored been this book in rejection of the Shia beliefs. So you want to say that Abaqat al-Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimat al-Adhar was written as a rebuttal or an answer.
Yes, that was a rebuttal book. But before we get into this book, we have to know that at its time, that book, I mean the book which had been produced by that Sunni author, was a good and strong book mm-hmm. in a way that it was circulating among Shia scholars, but they wouldn't prepare a good response for that. By that moment, late Sayyid Mir Hamad Hussein, he comes to this point that he has to benefit from all knowledge that he has gained through all those years.
That's right.
So he will produce a book which right now we can see that book in 10 volumes, although there are other records being 30 volumes or even 100 volumes.
Yes.
But what right now we have at hand is including 10 volumes. And the way he approached that Sunni book is regarded as a kind of very technical mm-hmm. and respectful. Because it is easy to refute something using words which are not appropriated
That's right.
for the field of actually scholarly field, or it is not appropriating mm-hmm. the academic area. But when we look at his work, we see that the way he is approaching all things in his book is really, really professional.
That's right.
And this is because of the author, because he is regarded as one of the prolific authors.
That's right.
He knew many things about the Quran. He knew many things about the Riwayat. So he divides his book into two parts. First part, he actually approaches all verses that have been employed in the Sunni book in order to reject the idea of Shiism.
That's right.
So one by one, mm-hmm. he will take all verses that some of which are really familiar
right.
for our listeners, like Innama waliyakumullah wa rasuluhu, or the other verse Al Yawm Akmaltu Lakum Dinakum, and the other verse that our listeners are familiar with. So he takes all these verses one after another, and he tries to actually refute the argument of the author in a way that, okay, Shiism had been and is being proven through these verses. And then
That's right.
gets into the actually field of the Riwayat.
So more than Shiism, I think it is about the concept of imamat, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
That's
because,
right.
Yeah.
Which is the main pillar of the Shia
main
beliefs.
Pillar of Shia beliefs.
And so maybe so many people from our Muslim brethren believe that there is no direct reference to the concept of imamat in the Holy Quran, but Mir Hamad Hussein Hendi and so many other scholars have proven that there are direct incidents and events mentioned in the Holy Quran through the ayahs of the Holy Quran that show the authenticity of the concept of imamate and the leadership and the successorship. This is a specialized field of study. I mean, maybe by mere studying the text of the Holy Quran, some people might not understand it. But if we get to the shan and nuzul of the ayat and the different incidents, and we have to know Arabic language, of course, and the exegesis of the Holy Quran, then we could understand that. That's right. Some references are made to the concept of imamat in the Holy Quran too. That's all right. So he wrote it in Farsi language, you know. And I think it is because the Farsi language was the mother tongue of that region, of the Indian subcontinent, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the Indian subcontinent.
Even we have Iqbal-e-Lahuri.
Iqbal-e-Lahuri writes in
composing
Farsi.
Composing poets in
Farsi. Poets in Farsi language, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all right. So Sheikh Ziyaniyal, let's get to you, brother. What information can you give us about Abaqat al-Anwar and the significance of this book? I mean, what is the high position of this book in the Shia library? Why is it so important?
As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdavi, mentioned, this book is written according to the book of Tuhfah Ithna Ashariya. And because that book was Persian, this book is also Persian.
You mean as an answer to that book?
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
And Tuhfah Ithna Ashariya is consisted of 12 chapters. And each chapter is talking about proper aspect of Shia school of thought. For example, first chapter is talking about the history of Shia school of thought and gives accusations regarding Shia school of thought.
That's right.
And most important part of the book is chapter 7, that is regarding imamate.
Imamate, that's right.
And Abaghatul Anwar and many other books, and this is not the only Abaghat, some other books also are written in this regard. They are trying to defend the Shia school of thought regarding the subject of imamate. And you know why? Because when the subject of imamate is proved and is accepted, then all these discussions should be put on the shelves. Because the milestone and the root of every discussion in the theology of Islam between the denominations is the topic of imamate. Mm-hmm. Because after the Holy Prophet's demise, we see that some of the Muslims, they try to say that, okay, the Holy Prophet did not appoint anyone. And some of Muslims, they would say that, no, Prophet appointed a person as his caliph and introduced Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. So if this discussion is solved, then the coming discussions that they are after this, they most, all of them are put aside.
That's right.
And there's no negotiation anymore.
Okay.
Yes, I believe in this, you believe in that.
Yes.
No problem. But we should understand each other's, reasoning.
That's right.
Why Abaghat is putting emphasis on this point.
That's right.
I mean, imamate.
Yes.
Because this is the most basic difference between Shia school of thought and Sunni school
and
of thought.
The beliefs, that's right. How is his style of writing or compilation?
Yeah. Of course, because this book is trying to answer the problems that are raised by the book of Tuhfah Ithna Ashariya, so it's obvious that this book is going through the subject of that book, the first one, I mean Tuhfah Ithna Ashariya.
Mm-hmm.
But Abaghatul Anwar itself have this manner that at the beginning, when it's about riwayat, it's trying to give the sources of riwayat, and then tries to give the chain of narrators, and then try to convey a research on these chain of narrators that's, who are these people?
That's right.
Are they authentic or not? And he proves that these are authentic.
That's right.
And then after approving this point that the chain of narrator is authentic and is accepted by all, so then he goes to the Dilala and to the argumentation
that's
based
right.
on the text of Rivayat.
Text of the Rivayat.
So he tries to say, okay, this Rivayat is a proof for the school of thought of Shia of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
So in this way, alhamdulillah, both sides are covered.
That's
I mean,
right.
the Sanad,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the tracing back the Rivayat to Ahlul Bayt, to
yes.
the Holy Prophet.
Yes.
And then secondly, the Dilalat or the
okay.
Reasoning that is derived okay. from the text.
Because the Shiism was accused that some of these narrations are not authentic
or
does not
fake,
have
yeah.
enough wusukh. So Amir Hamad Hossein Hendi shows that they are authentic, even maybe based on the Sunni references
yeah, for
too.
Sure.
And this is the great, we can say, point.
And another important point regarding this book is that many of the subjects of the book is taken from the Sunni sources.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a Shia-based book
Shia-based
to answer
book.
The problems from own point of view,
okay.
but he tries to give evidences from Sunni books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important point regarding this book
that's right.
that have made it, famous.
Okay. And it was acknowledged by so many outstanding, high-quality asatid professors and scholars of the Shia world, Sheikh Mahdavi, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. And among them, we may name Allama Amini, who is the author of
yes.
Al-Ghadir. He
yes.
himself has authored a book in favor or in defense of
yes.
Shiism,
yes.
Giving this focus on the hadith of Al-Ghadir and the incident and event of Al-Ghadir Khum.
Yes.
But he himself, when it comes to the point to acknowledge the book of Abaghat, he is saying very noble words and exalting this work of Marhum Mir Hamad Hussein, saying
right.
that the nice smell of this book
mm-hmm.
has spread all world, from the West to the East. Mm-hmm. So someone like Allama Amini, who has authored a book regarding the Imamat, is acknowledging the Book of Abaqat. Again, we see Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani. He himself is considered as one of the great and outstanding codicologists who have compiled the name of more than 50,000 books in his compilation, which is called Al-Dhari'a ila Tasanif al-Shi'a. In his book, again, he is acknowledging Abaqat al-Anwar. So having this understanding about the all works from the Shia authors, he comes to this point to again acknowledge and admire the work that the author of Abaqat has conducted. So it's really a good work, and this is not except for his purity, his hard working, as it is said in the memories and stories that happened for him. They're saying that even the time his son passed away, not more than 1 hour he dedicated for the funeral thing, and the rest of the works and efforts he left it in the hands of the relatives.
His eyesight and his right hand for writing.
Yes,
you know,
so it says he was a really prolific, non-stop writing author who dedicated his whole life to defend from the actually school of Ahlul Bayt. May Allah bless him.
May Allah bless him. That's why he was really admired by so many outstanding other scholars like Mirza Shirazi, as you said. We can say Sheikh Zainuddin Mazandarani and also Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi, who write in admiration of Abaqat al-Anwar in defense of the Shia beliefs. Safar 18, 1306, according to the Hijra calendar, is the day in which he passed away, and his body was taken to a Husainia known as Jinab Qufran Ma'ab. He passed away with them, buried over there, and a commemoration session and gathering was held for him in Iraq, in Atabat. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Amin Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, mainly known as Mir Hamid Hussein Hindi, known by his book Abaqat al-Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimat al-Athar. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Zainia and Sheikh Mahdavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi Aman Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.